Welcome. This week's show with Ecta Call is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America and Sassy Jack Stitchery. A new thing you want to note at the Embroiderers Guild of America is the 22nd Through the Needle's Eye exhibit. This will be displayed virtually at the 2023 National Seminar in Boston, and then as a three-month live display in Louisville, then on the EGA website. It'll include member original and adaptation needlework, and the theme is Celebrate the Diversity in Embroidery. Now, this is the 2023 National Seminar, but you need to note that the first step is to get registered, and that registration is open now through December 31. Quite a lead time on this, so get registered now if you want to participate, and all the details are in the events section of the EGA website. And then a new class that is being offered is Lazy Summer Day, taught by Judy Borison Caruso. And registration is open now through August 4. And of course, encourage you to visit the EGAUSA.org website. Lots of free things for non-members. The gallery is a treat to go through. And on top of all of it, join EGA. You won't regret it. So much to offer on so many fronts for needleworkers, and worth every penny. So join them, EGAUSA.org. Our other sponsor, Sassy Jack Stitchery, and Kim at Sassy Jack's, Kim and company getting ready to move into their new storefront, the Baird House, in early fall. So we look forward to that. And then, of course, we have projects that we're doing with Kim and Sassy Jack's, the Marion Lang sampler, the Mary Jane Fry 1861 sampler, the Botany Bay sampler, and the Take Wing sampler. All of those kits available at the Sassy Jack's website. And now here's an additional word from Kim.
Sassy Jack Stitchery is happy to be a sponsor of Fiber Talk. We so appreciate all the heart that Gary and team put into their show, and we always look forward to each episode. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for all you do for our needlework world. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant needlework shop located in the mountains of western North Carolina, just north of Asheville. We're in the process of moving our shop to its forever home in a historic Folk Victorian on the National Listing of Historic Places, just 3 miles down the road from our current location. While we're moving, you can find us in all our normal online haunts, our website at sassyjackstitchery.com, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We can't wait to open our doors and welcome you into our new old home. It was always the plan to be in this beautiful old house, and we've invested a huge chunk of our hearts into its renovation. Every renovated board, every push-button light switch, every old porch swing has lovingly, mostly, been placed there with our own hands. It has a wonderful, warm, welcoming feel about the place already, and your stitchy joy and laughter with friends will really make it home for Sassy Jack's. So look for us online for the next few months, as we'll be filling online and phone orders as per usual, and we'll be looking forward to the spring at the Baird House in Asheville, North Carolina. When the time comes, we'll leave the light on for you, just like your mom did when you were a kid, so you'll know it's time to come home. Now on to the show.
Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from England, Ecta Call. Ecta, welcome.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for having me here.
Good to have you with us. Now, I ran into you on Instagram, and you are known for embroidered maps. And
that's right.
Yeah, and it was most intriguing to me, and I followed you for a while now, short while, and every time you post something, it just fascinates me. And I have to say that my initial reaction to embroidered maps was kind of a benefit of the doubt thing, like, well, that's interesting. But as I followed you and thought about it, and then particularly getting ready to talk to you today, I started to think, what if I did a map? And then I thought, you know, I grew up in a small farm town in Michigan. And I thought, now I get it. If I do a map of my hometown, all the memories I could stitch into that map. And so my mind just started churning, and it really, the light went on, and it really clicked for me as to why people want to follow you and do these maps. This is, I actually got excited. So how does this map thing start?
First of all, thank you for such a lovely introduction. And I'm so glad that, you were able to kind of visualize what it would look like if you were to retrace your steps and kind of go back to your, childhood and kind of relive those moments through a map. I think for me, maps are primarily storytelling devices, right? So they are beautiful as objects, obviously. But what I love about them is their ability to hold narrative. When we look at maps, historical maps, there's a certain narrative that we understand from them, geographic. For instance, what places looked like or looked like at a certain time. But also, if you go one layer deeper, you start to think about who's telling that story and who's the narrator here. And therefore, you start to see the hand of the cartographer, not in just the way objects and places are represented, but also what actually makes it on the map and what is edited out. Isn't it that such an interesting exercise? And as you said, making maps ourselves somehow transport us back to a certain place, physical place, but also a state of being, like an emotional space as well. So mm-hmm. I think these maps are so multi-layered. And to me, making them in textiles hold a particular significance. It's almost like, combining of these two very potent elements. Textiles, as we know, have this fantastic ability to evoke emotions, like almost instantly. This is the only material that we sort of spend most of our lives with, being yeah. engaged and involved so intimately. It's the first thing that we know as babies, being wrapped in that, and then the last thing when we leave this world. So I think they are our fellow travelers and their ability to connect us with emotive states or with memories is just incredible. And as I was saying to you, that for me, making maps on textiles is particularly significant because then I'm able to harness the ability of not only the material, but also what I am saying with the material.
Yeah.
In that, making maps.
Well, in that, yeah, there's history, there's memories, there's a sense of place. But then also that the other part that stands out for me when I look at your work is the lines and forms that come out of stitching roads and lakes and rivers and so on and so forth. Which of that speaks to you the most? Is it the art part of the line shapes and forms, or is it the memories, the history part?
I think it's probably both.
Okay.
I mean, in my work, it's line that I'm most interested in and exploring. In general, my work is very minimalistic, and I like to, it to express what I want to express using sort of the very essence of something. So it's kind of pairing the idea back right to its most essential and then taking it on to form shapes of places. But also I feel that what I'm trying to pursue in my maps is this sense of harmony and balance and like a quiet, understated elegance. And therefore, the choice of stitches, which are primarily, I use a lot of running stitch in my work, which is like one of the most simple stitches. So the idea of simplicity is very much ingrained in into the work. And exploring line is a big focus. And the place obviously becomes very important, you know, in the places that I'm choosing to make maps of are personally important to me. Or if I'm working with clients, which are often, you know, private collectors or museums or heritage sector organizations. I think in all of this, we are trying to commemorate the place and memories associated with place. So like last year, just before the pandemic hit, I was on an artist residency in Chinatown in Soho, London. And this is, you know, Chinatown has existed in London for nearly 200 years or possibly longer. And the brief was to commemorate the place and celebrate the hidden stories of the diaspora. So in my research, I found so many stories about the place that are often overlooked because it tends to be a touristic district. You know, people come in, enjoy the food and, you know, sights, but not really engage with the history and heritage of the place. So for me, it was really interesting to do a map that draws attention to these stories. So yes, the notion of history is certainly there, and the personal stories or the hidden stories, again, is a beautiful motif that I try and bring into my maps.
When you have students do maps, is I assume that they tend to do like my hometown or some other kind of memory for their maps. Is that pretty typical, or do they tend toward more historic things?
I think typically it's their own personal, personally significant places. So, you know, like their hometowns, or sometimes they would do like a significant journey, for instance, that meant something to them, whether they traveled as a family or, you know, they traveled with their partner. So I think journeys and places are a kind of recurring motif.
Yeah.
When the students come and work with me. And I think it's just something so beautiful being able to revisit places that we have known intimately and to be able to, you know, have a physical expression of these. I mean, photographs are one, but increasingly they also live on our phones, don't they? We never really managed to print any of those out. Yeah, these millions of memories of moments spent with our loved ones and in places that we care about, but you know, it lives somewhere in the cloud, and we have no physical reminders of those. So I think making something as physical, as tactile as a map on cloth has like an even added significance in the present context. I mean, furthermore, I think that making something slowly and over a period of time, which obviously with hand stitch you will, it's not something that you would produce instantly as a photograph. And therefore, there is more of you involved in the making, and the joy that one derives out of it, I think, is multifold, more than, say, for example, what clicking a picture might be on our phone.
Right. well, see, that's the process that I went through once I got hooked in. And I have to admit, I've spent plenty of mental energy on what my hometown map would look like, because I really got hooked into, okay, I have to put this friend's house because I have this memory of this friend. So they have to go, you know, and then how would I stitch that house? And then each of the schools, elementary, middle school, and high school, I would have to because I walked to all of them, and of course that was uphill both ways in the winter. But so I would have to have the paths that I walked to those schools, and the houses I passed. And so it just starts to build in your head, and and before long, I had a pretty good map laid out in my head of my hometown from my childhood, and it was really a fun mental exercise, just doing that much because. Yeah. Yeah. And then the memories it brought back that were just, you know, shoved in the back somewhere.
Yeah, right. I mean, you haven't, like, for example, thought about those things in a very long time. And it's lovely to be reunited with those memories. I think you should make the map, Gary. come and join me.
Yeah, well, I think I might at least get pencil and paper out and start to stitch it or draw it out just to see. Because it was an unexpected pleasure that I got out of it, and the memories that came back, and the thing that I like about the way you go about the maps is a person would think, oh, you know, to stitch a map, you know, what an intimidating project, but the approach you take is really quite simple, and it seems to me rather fast, so that if you wanted to do a fairly large map, it would not be an intimidating project.
It is. I like to keep things very, very simple. You know, as I was saying earlier, that my work aims to be celebrating the idea of simplicity, and that kind of goes right down to my materials, stitches, and approach. And yeah, as you were saying, you know, to be able to draw that out and rewalk those paths again. So, and then once you have the drawing, then it's just a matter of kind of converting or drawing that out on fabric and then beginning to stitch. So my students really enjoy that, you know, from having had this notion of making a map in their heads for a very long time, and then to come for a short course visit, which is typically over 2 days, they're able to, you know, get that started and, you know, really kind of take that to a stage where they are able to then progress on to making it themselves. So over those 2 days, I introduce them to the way I make maps, and I teach them techniques, stitch techniques that lend themselves to cartography very easily, that evoke places effectively, and then really how to not only embroider the maps but also finish them. So it's like, all in all, it's a lovely way of kind of condensing that process in a way that it becomes very accessible and it takes the overwhelm out of it.
Do you do most of yours just in one color, right? Is that generally how you approach all of this?
Primarily, yes. I love working in monochrome, so I tend to work with a cream background, which often tends to be linen. I love working with linen because of its slubby, characterful surface, and then embroider it in black. But having said that, you know, there are several maps that I have worked on in the past and more recently where I've introduced color as well. For instance, just recently I worked on a commission for a lovely client who asked me to work on 4 different places on a single map. So the idea was to kind of commemorate 4 places that have been significant in her partner's life because it was a gift meant for him. So the place that he was born, where he grew up, and then where he went and worked. So it was almost like, you know, a map of this person's life. And in that, they wanted particular colors to be introduced, which was a fun exercise for me. So, it kind of the black and cream become an easy framework to then start introducing color
Right.
in.
Right.
But again, it stays minimal. It's never like, that the color is the big emphasis. It's not. It's very much the line that is the emphasis. And to that end, working with monochrome really lends itself
Yeah.
to that minimal approach.
Yeah. Now, when you have classes, as people start working on their maps,
Yes.
does it get quiet because people are reflecting on what they're stitching, or does it get noisy because people start swapping stories?
I think it's a lovely mixture of the
Okay.
two. Working with stitch yourself, you would know that there are phases when we really need to concentrate and we just need to be with our own thoughts. But then there are others where, it's kind of more of a creative exchange. So I encourage that kind of vibe in my classes that, they have reflective pauses built in, but at the same time, the atmosphere is very convivial and it's very warm. It's people aren't told off if they start chatting. In
Yeah.
fact, that is encouraged because I feel, and especially during the pandemic when we were all so isolated and not really speaking with very many people, it was lovely to have had this community of, other like-minded people who you could sort of geek out with, right? You could talk about,
Yep.
different kinds of stitches and materials and yarns, and also talk about, creative stuff. So yeah, I think the classes are in a way they are the space where these sort of creative conversations flow very easily. But equally, if one wants to be
Yeah.
just reflective and quiet, that is also honored. So yeah, they're very easygoing, and my aim is to create a feeling, especially in my online ones, that we are all sitting in a room around a big table and that's just chatting while making work.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Now you grew up in India.
That's right.
First person from India needleworker I've been able to talk to, and so I'm most curious because there's such a style, just textiles in general, such bright colors and such a different style that we get out of India, and learn from your mother, grandmother. Where did your stitching come from?
Well, thanks for that question because it just allows me to revisit my childhood and share about the India that I grew up in. Well, I, as I said, in my first introduction to stitch was really my mum and my grandma, who lived with us till she passed. So I was very lucky to have these women, kind of introducing me to making, but in a very sort of gentle, inobtrusive way. It was always like this fun thing to help out my grandma, who would make quilts. So she used to kind of salvage any and every fabric around the house that was no longer being used, and then when her great big bag filled with these fabric pieces, she would start to make quilts. And my mom was, although she had a very busy academic career, she was a scientist. She would come back home and in the evening sit and embroider. And I think that was, that must have been her way to de-stress, right? To kind of tune out of whatever rigors of academia and go into a more creative state of being. So I think those were two, my introduction to stitch. But in general, growing up in India, I was so lucky to be surrounded by this heritage of handmade textiles, you know, what my mother wore or what we had at home as bedspreads and quilts were these incredibly made, hand-printed, hand-woven textiles.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that must have subliminally, you know, subconsciously become part of my own artistic voice. That said, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the vibrant colors from India are very much known, or rather people have seen those kinds of textiles predominantly. They associate that with Indian textiles. However, there's also a very rich tradition of white-on-white embroidery, which comes from Lucknow. It's called chikankari, and it's white shadow work, which is done on semi-translucent fabric, and the thread also white. And it's just incredibly detailed and beautiful. It's been done for centuries. Then in southern India, there is a tradition of wearing off-white, just, you know, like cream draped cloth, often with very subtle gold borders woven in into them. So, you know, those kinds of textiles are not that widely recognized today. However, they have existed for centuries, and till about 300 years ago, India was the world leader in exporting handmade textiles, where they were whether they were hand woven or hand printed or embroidered. So there is, you know, a 5,000 year old tradition of making textiles, which I feel so incredibly lucky to have grown around and really observing and learning from. So, yeah, I think that has had a big influence
mm-hmm.
in.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that, now see, that's what I love about doing these conversations is yes, living in America my entire life, I have a perception of textiles in India, and that's bright colors, vibrant, you know, gorgeous. Yeah, all of those things. And then, but I never think about, it's such a vast country region that there has to be different types of cultures and therefore different types of needlework. And, and if we're not exposed to them, we don't come to appreciate the other opportunities that there are. To do different kind, like white on white. I mean, that's one of my favorite things is white work, and I would never mm-hmm. have thought of white work coming out of India. So, yeah.
Well, indeed. I mean, as you said, that you know, there are certain things that kind of become associated almost like stereotypically. So it's good to break out of those, and you know, kind of widen our horizons.
Right.
And yeah, you're so right. India is not just one country. It's a subcontinent. It's a vast, vast melange of different, I mean, there are like 27 languages, official languages
oh
with
my.
Their own script, spoken and written. And that's just the languages. And then there are obviously the colloquial versions of things as well. So we are talking about a very rich heritage in material culture, not just in textiles, but also, but what gets talked about, you know, it's interesting who's telling the story. <isn't it? laughs> Come back to that idea of who's the narrator,
Right. Yeah.
and what are they choosing to talk about? And therefore, that becomes popular culture, that becomes the popular story associated with a certain place or a culture.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that, you know, there are passionate people like you who are not following that. You're actually inviting others from different influences and backgrounds into your podcast, and then making people aware of other ways of thinking and other ways of making. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, I have an ongoing problem of curiosity, so it just it's okay, it's okay. So you get to, so I'm getting this picture of you have an opportunity to grow up in this multi-generational environment where needlework and art through needle and thread is present, but you weren't forced to do it. You were allowed to learn and take advantage if you wanted to, and so it clearly it spoke to you, and you picked up and ran with it, and what a great opportunity, because you weren't forced and you weren't prevented, you were given the opportunity.
Yeah, and you know, it was because the majority of my family were in either into academia or, you know, my cousins were going and joining med school and they were becoming engineers. So just to be kind of rebellious and perverse, it's like, I am not going to be doing what you guys are doing. So therefore I went and signed up at this design school that I'd hardly heard anything about. So yeah, no, it was very much nurturing. You know, my parents never really forced me to do anything. They would have been as happy if I had picked up something else entirely. So I feel very fortunate that I was able to just follow my curiosity and, you know, where it led. And initially, my training was in apparel design with an emphasis on textile. So I learned how to design and make clothing, also learned how to make textiles. But I found increasingly that my true passion and joy lay in textiles. I wasn't so interested in form and exploring form. It was really the surface that intrigued me, and you know, I was really excited about creating different types of surfaces. So that's what I pursued. And after I graduated from National Institute of Design in Ahmedabad in India, I came to the UK to do a master's degree in textiles. And it's so funny. I was offered a place at RISD in the States, Rhode Island School of Design. But somehow that didn't quite happen. My plan B was to come to the UK, but I got offered this amazing scholarship. I was selected for a scholarship that enabled me to travel and come and study. It was a full scholarship, not just my tuition was taken care of, but also travel and living expenses. So it was like, do I want a loan
Yeah.
and go to the States? Or do I want to, you know, have a fully funded place? So I chose purely based on that. It's very pragmatic
Hey,
concerns.
money speaks. Money
Regular.
speaks. You got it.
So that's how I landed up in the UK. I went and studied in Scotland in Edinburgh, and did my ME there, where I got the chance to really, you know, just make things and enjoy the process and learn and experiment and explore. So for me, it was just a chance to hone into my own voice, my own way of looking at the world, And the MA provided me with that kind of time where I could just tune out from everything else and then just focus on my own, developing my own work.
Yeah. Well, and nothing beats being able to go to school and not have to hold down a part-time job just so you can put food on the table. Yeah, to be able to just immerse yourself in your studies is a huge plus. And of course, to go to the UK, I mean, no trouble finding textile art in the UK. I mean, that's pretty easy to do. So
that's right. Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was. Where I was, where the college was, you know, it had very easy access to Scottish mills. And it was lovely to see, you know, what's it called? Oh, gosh, the name has flown out of my head. But the water tarns in the mill. Have you seen those old-fashioned mills?
I've seen them, but yeah.
It was incredible to see that, you know, in action right down the road, and Scotland has its own very rich history of textiles, so it was a lovely place to be. And then I came down to London to first to Bath to set up my practice. And then eventually moved to London, which is where I've been for the last decade or so.
So, and that's interesting to me too, because quite a culture change from India, I would assume, from India to the UK and certainly to London. But it obviously mm-hmm. works for you since you've stayed there. Do you, in your artwork, do you yes. still, does your Indian art training still influence work that you do, or has it become all one? I mean, how has that played in your head?
I think it would be very difficult to pinpoint that this influence comes from India and this comes from Scandinavia and this comes
okay.
from London.
Okay.
To me, it's you know, these places have certainly had an influence on my artistic voice, but I can never say that 5% of it is from India and 25 is from there. And mm-hmm. I'm not even interested in that kind of investigation. What I'm interested in is the idea and how to express it.
Yeah.
And pursuing this idea of place, I think it just allows me to reacquaint myself with places in my own memory, in my own story, but also, you know, new places that I may not be very familiar with. So it becomes a segue into understanding the histories of places.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes segue into understanding, you know, how something has been shaped by time and influences. So I find that idea very, very interesting as an artist.
Yeah. Well, you have a statement in the bio on your website that has stuck with me, making with meaning. And and I love that. Because it starts my wheel spinning.
Thanks, Gary. I think that's primarily, if I were to say it in one sentence, I think it would be that you know, I'm pursuing this idea of meaning. What meaning does a place hold for us? As you were talking earlier about you know, this map. Where you were thinking about your hometown and you were thinking about these paths that you walked on and the friends. So certainly it has meaning for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes like the central philosophy or what I'm trying to do within my work is to pursue and explore how places have a meaning for us and how we like to express it. Like this map that I made, one of my earliest maps that I made were a map of Delhi and a map of London, because I was trying to, in my own head, understand what home means to me. And because these two cities that now I call home were, you know, they are so vastly different in not only in terms of geography, but also the culture. And, you know, I was essentially trying to understand what it means to call a place home, and when does it start, any random city, when does it start feeling like home? So the map making really helped me understand that, like to illustrate that, let me give you an example. So when I was making the map of Delhi, it was so easy for me. I was able to pinpoint the places that, for instance, you know, there are streets where my dad taught me how to drive. You know, drawing those and making those were like, you know, kind of revisiting that and reliving those memories. And that's such a direct way to understand. Like, yes, that's why it feels like home to me. And as I had kind of moved to London at the time recently, I hadn't, you know, it's not a city that I was born in and grew up in. So making the map of London, I thought, you know, I'll be able to at least understand what I'm trying to, you know, why has this city started to mean so much to me? And it completely took me by surprise. I hadn't spent those many years in London, and yet I had made memories here, you know. So for instance, in Hyde Park, there was one birthday that I celebrated with my friends, and just thinking about that made me spy when I drew Hyde Park on my map and then eventually stitched it, and you know, where my studio was and where my home is and the walks that I like to take. All of those things were suddenly, you know, manifested in front of me, physically there, visually to see. And that whole exercise felt so cathartic. I thought I was able to claim the city as my own, you know, to understand it so in such a way, in a visual and tactile way. So from there, this little seed of meaning grew. So I was able to find meaning through making something. And then that has become kind of the central leitmotif of the park since then.
It's so interesting, because listening to you say that, because we just moved from Illinois to Missouri, from Chicago area to the St. Louis area, after 28 years in one house, and we've been married 43 years, so 43 years in the same area. And we've had many discussions about that very thing. When does a place become home? And because we're going through that transition now, and so now you got me going about maps, how a map can help illustrate that. Mm-hmm. And oh, what fun! See, that's the thing about these maps that has really hooked me, is when you, like, if I look at a post you put on Instagram, oh, that's an interesting map, and I look around and see some of the features and things. But it's when you step back and you start to think about the levels below just the stitching that are in that map, that it really comes to life. And it's so fun. Yeah. I just applaud you. I think it's great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I think it also takes a certain kind of person to respond to that. And I'm so glad that, you know, you've taken to the map making, and hopefully we'll see you making a map of your new area. And then, you know, that might help make it home.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, I start to think about that. Because right now, our understanding of the area we live is really fairly limited to what routes we've learned by rote, so we can get to the grocery store and our daughter's house and those kinds of things. And you know, over time, you start to branch out. But yeah, oh boy, what fun! What fun! Bravo for you! Yay!
thank you.
So when you finished your master's, did that put you in a position to start a business? Or did you continue with needlework as more of a hobby and work a job just to make money? How did that transition happen?
Let me think back to what exactly happened. So I was very focused on setting up my practice straight away.
Okay.
So as soon as I graduated, I wanted to... I was actually very lucky. I remember at my degree show, which was down in London, every year there is a showcase of all the design graduates in the UK. And there's a great big exhibition space where this show takes place. It's called New Designers. And people come in to see what's the latest, you know, that creative industry professionals across board. I mean, curators, artists of all kinds and stripes come in and see this event and really celebrate what the new graduates have been doing. So just from that one show, and I was very fortunate to be selected for that. In fact, I was the only master's student selected from my university, and there were other undergraduate students. So I was spotted by a curator who offered me a solo exhibition from that show, and also a wonderful store at the time, which was very close to the Victoria and Albert Museum. They also happened to visit this store, this show, and they bought some of my work. So it was even better than I could have ever hoped for as a graduating student, that I had an exhibition to walk towards, and I had this, you know, someone interested enough in my work to buy it straight away. So it really that got me started. And because I was new in the country, I didn't really know how things worked here in the UK. But I was just determined to do my own thing and not really have to resort to taking a job up.
Wow.
So I applied for many things. I mean, whatever opportunities were available in the way of, you know, being able to set up a small studio. And mind you, I didn't have a studio, right? My husband and I were at the time in a one bedroom apartment. Uh-huh.
Standard
Edinburgh
startup. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So, not really knowing much about the way things worked here, and you know, I would just trawl on Google and find out about what if there were any bursaries or awards going or competitions, and I chanced upon this award from the Crafts Council in England, which was a 2-year long residency, which provided a studio space, a small studio space within a university, and also some mentoring support. So that was really, I mean, I made an application, they invited me for an interview, and then I got selected for this award, which was amazing, because only 6 people across England and Wales were selected, and I was one of them.
Yeah.
So, yay, I know. It was amazing. It was really cool. And so from Edinburgh, I moved to Bath, which is where my residency was going to be at the university, or Bath Spa University in the textiles department. And I'm so incredibly grateful for this award, but because really that was my seed capital, right? That is how I could access equipment and have a studio space to myself. I was asked to do a bit of teaching in return, which was amazing, also because I love sharing my skills and I love the idea of teaching. I'd seen both my parents do it, their professors, as I said. So, my childhood was steeped in academia, so it all felt like, oh, of course, you, why wouldn't you teach at a university? So yeah, life sort of came full circle there. So yeah, that's what I did. That's how I got started. And I was there for 3 years, the next 3 years, which was really from very, very initial stages of thinking about what am I going to make and where am I going to show it and who is going to eventually buy it? All of those questions. I did have a Saturday job. Oh yeah, I just remembered, in a little gallery in Bath. Yeah, but thanks to the award and the teaching, I was able to get my business off the ground and keep it going. Eventually, I moved to London, as I said, 3 years later, because I found that all my clients were in London. I was doing all the exhibitions that I was doing, they were in London. And also, it was like a more vibrant place. I mean, Bath is beautiful. I don't know if you've ever been, but it's very Jane Austen.
No.
It's like Georgian and 17th century. Beautiful, beautiful architecture, but it felt a bit quiet for a young couple. So we would find ourselves on the train to London every other weekend, and then we said, like, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing this? Why don't we just move to London? So we did, and I think there were a lot of, for me, I'm quite a city girl. I love having everything at my doorstep, and I love the buzz of living in a big city. So for me, then when I was in my life at that time, I could trade a very quiet countryside.
I'd head to the countryside in a heartbeat.
Oh yeah.
No
So
thanks.
now I'm warming up to that. But yeah, 10 years ago, it felt like a really exciting move for my husband and I, and we did. And luckily for us, I think London embraced us, and we embraced London, and we've never really looked back. It's been really, really lovely. I love the idea that, when you sit on the tube, the underground, and I'm going to my studio, on an average day, I hear, 10 different languages being spoken at the same time. People are all over the world, and it's such a melting pot of different cultures. It has some of the best art museums right at the doorstep. So as an artist, I feel that, I feed off a lot from the energy of the place and the vibrance of the place. And it just works for me, being immersed in all of that. It's an incredibly diverse place and a vibrant place. So yeah, can't complain.
Well, yeah, and as an artist, constant stimulation from all quarters is certainly a plus, no doubt. And okay, so now teaching. Now we gotta you teach maps, like people can take classes on how to do maps, but then you have other techniques that you teach, and I'm most interested in these. Is it Kantha and Shibori? Is that right?
That's right.
Oh, I got them
So,
right. Yay, yay for me.
yes. Yeah, Yes, I love teaching, and I love this idea of, people, helping people connect with their creativity. All of us, I think, when we are little, we are fantastic artists because we don't judge ourselves or we haven't been judged by other humans. But somewhere along the way, most of us get busy and, lose touch with our creativity. So I love this idea of reintroducing people to expressing themselves through stitch. And map making is certainly one of the ones that I teach regularly. I teach people how to embroider bespoke maps of places that are important to them. But the other interests of mine are Kantha stitches, which is a heritage textile from India. Kantha textiles are made by layering cast off cloth. So, typically you'd have old cotton saris that were too worn out to continue wearing. So, women in Bengal would layer these sometimes 3 to 5 layers of very fine cotton and then stitch them in using running stitch primarily, but also several other techniques into these really beautiful textiles that have motifs that are narrative. So, often they would tell stories about daily life, but also a lot of motifs are drawn from folk tales, from mythology, from religious iconography. So these are fantastic, as I love them because they not only celebrate sustainability in that, they were repurposing what was to hand and not just throwing it out in the bin, which is an approach we are only now beginning to cotton on to, isn't it? We're now talking about recycling and repurposing, recycling. But this has been done in India for centuries. And it's unfortunate that it hasn't been recognized as such. But so to me, it was my kind of natural choice to start teaching, because one, I love running stitch. Two, I love the approach of Kantha. Three, it's a narrative and surface design technique. So for me, it kind of works on several different layers,
mm-hmm.
and also connects me with my own culture, with my own heritage, and I get to introduce others who may not necessarily know about it. The stitch shibori is also another one. I mean, basically they are stitch resist textiles. Shibori is a Japanese word, but India also has a phenomenal tradition of resist dyed textiles. You might have heard of bandhani, which are tie and dye textiles. So they are like tiny bits of cloth are pinched and then a thread is tied around them, and they are immersed in a dye pot. Later on, the thread bindings are taken off and the most intricate of patterns emerge.
Mm.
So I've been very interested in this since my design school days, and teaching them is kind of an opportunity to revisit it and explore it in multiple different ways. And I teach it using natural dyes. So, the whole process is very much sustainable. It is about using what we have to hand, in our kitchens, in our gardens, without having to resort to chemicals. So, yeah, for me, again, very, very interesting ideas to introduce people to.
Yeah. And I assume you offer these classes in your studio, but these days offering them online also?
That's right. Initially, before the pandemic, they all used to be in my studio in central London. And last year, when the pandemic struck, I think it was towards the end of March here in the UK that we went into the first of many, many lockdowns.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys have had a nice parade of those. Yes.
So it was literally, I mean, we've slightly lost count of how many we've had. I think it's three, four, certainly. So yes, we went into a proper lockdown. I think for the first 4 months, it was literally like you weren't even allowed to step out of your house other than buying your groceries or, you know, going for that half an hour of walk. So in that scenario, doing classes in a physical environment was just not possible. And I started teaching online. And initially it happened on this idea that I wanted to kind of give back, you know. I was thinking, how am I responding to this disaster as an artist? And when I look back at this time in my life, what do I want to remember? You know, do I want to remember as a tragic time, or do I want this to mean something else, something more positive for myself? And I chose the latter, and I basically decided that I have skills and I am just going to share them. So I started with something that I called Soothing Stitch, which was a gathering for people to come together every Friday, absolutely free. And we explored words. Initially, it began with words that, you know, we found hopeful. So, you know, someone chose the word hope, someone else chose nature, whatever, you know, that one little word prompt that would help us connect with something positive is how it really began. When I decided to do this completely on a whim, I was just chatting with my husband and saying that, you know, I know I have the internet and I have my hands, but how do I connect? And he is, he's a techie. He works in AI, artificial intelligence, and, you know, a world away from me. But he suggested, why don't I try Zoom? And I didn't really know what Zoom was at the time. But these are the levels of my tech savviness. I was like, what is Zoom even? So yeah, he introduced me to Zoom, and I just put out a post completely on an impulse on Instagram saying, like, look, this is what I'm thinking, and if you'd like to join me, you know, just DM me. And literally from it just exploded from there, you know. I was suddenly, you know, I had these multiple messages that I filled up one, and then I had to cap it because I didn't even know how I was going to do it. And I added another session and another. And then soon it became like an every Friday thing. And then, you know, these lovely people started asking me, well, what else do you do?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I could teach this. So really, you know, my first tentative steps in digital teaching happened during the lockdown. And I must be doing something right because it's sort of gone wrong from strength to strength. And I've been teaching fairly regularly now for the last 1.5 years online, and people from all over the world have been able to join, which I feel so happy about because earlier, you know, geography was a challenge. The people who did come to my studio were mostly those who were in and around the UK. I mean, sure, I had some international students, but then, you know, it's a flight and it's travel, all of which certainly limited the you know, people who could come in for these. But since having started teaching online, It's like geography has suddenly, we've been able to transcend
Right. No,
geography.
there's no doubt that is one of the huge pluses out of this pandemic is just that for people like you, it has opened doors to audiences and students that would never have been opened otherwise. And
Yeah, completely.
yeah.
And being someone who likes to work most of the times with my fingers, and not really someone who lives very comfortably in the digital media. I think for me also, it has been it has been getting comfortable with being online and being able to find a way of teaching and communicating that still has a warmth around it, still has its humanity, and just being able to connect with others who are, who are on a creative journey, and just being able to help them and guide them has really meant a lot to me, especially during the pandemic.
Yeah. And thank God for technically oriented spouses, huh?
Absolutely. Thank God.
Where
Yeah.
would you be?
Well, certainly not on Zoom.
Yep.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
All credit to him, honestly. I mean, when he said, "Well, how are you going to teach? Why don't you try a multiple device setup?" And that slightly blew my mind. I was like, "What do you even mean?" Yeah.
Yep.
So
Well,
definitely all the credit of the tech goes directly to my husband.
yep. You're not alone there. Trust me, you're not alone. Not at all. Well, Ekta, this has been such a treat. Thanks for making time and sharing your story. Really have enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a treat equally for me as well.
Yep. All right, and thanks to everyone for listening.